between Revelation 17 and Revelation 19, the kings, Revelation 19, verse 19, and I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat upon the horse and against his army. Now, it's obviously the same battle. 10 kings go to war against the Lamb, Revelation 17, and Revelation 19, we find that the kings of the earth go to war against him who is called King of Kings and Lord of Lords, who in turn, of course, is the Lamb, the one whose vesture is dipped in blood. Therefore, if Revelation 19, as attested to by the Spirit of prophecy, is a description of the Battle of Armageddon, then what must Revelation 17 be?
Same thing
precisely. It is also a description of the Great Battle of Armageddon. At this point, we'll now identify these 10 kings, which is spoken about in verse 12, and the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Who are these 10 kings? The common interpretation is to say that there are 10 kings found back in Daniel chapter 7. The 10 kings symbolized by the 10 horns upon that great nondescript dragon beast, which symbolized pagan Rome, out of whose head rose the little horn, which uprooted 3 of the first horns by the roots and replaced them, leaving 7 of the originals and that new horn in its place. Today, one might say that modern France is the successor of ancient Gaul, that various other nations have grown out of the original powers, the Saxons, or the Anglo-Saxons, for instance, become the British people, the Alemanno, the Germans, and so forth. And in fact, the French still call Germany Alemannia. Isn't that right? Yeah, where's it gone? Yeah. Now, however, this particular prophecy calls for kings which have received no power as kings yet, and don't get power as kings until what point of time? Till the beast gets his power. Now, at the present time, any nation which is descended from those original 10 horns and the remaining 7 horns does have power as a king. Is England today a sovereign state? Does it have power as a king? Certainly. Does Germany? Sure. Now, it doesn't mean it has to have a crown king necessarily. England does, but Germany doesn't. It has a chancellor, isn't it? What do they call him?
President.
Right, a president. And most nations today have a president or a dictator in their leadership. But the point is, you cannot today point to a single existing governmental power which does not have sovereign power. Therefore, it's no use on our part looking to any of those powers today as being the powers spoken about by these 10 kings. Therefore, any interpretation which looks to the 10 kings of ancient Europe as being the 10 kings of Revelation 17 is a misinterpretation. We're looking for something else. We're looking for powers or kings which have received no power as kings yet, or which have received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings for only 1 hour with the beast. All right then. Now, let's start searching to see what the Word of God says in regard to these 10 kings. I asked you to remember that yesterday that in Revelation 12, the beast there had 7 heads and 10 horns, but where were the horns placed? On the horns and on the heads? On the heads. In that case, let's just illustrate this on the blackboard today. Right, Revelation 12. Now, all you excellent students of prophecy, what power is symbolized by the dragon beast of Revelation 12?
Pagan Rome.
Good, pagan Rome. So here we have pagan Rome. And in this case, we find that there are heads and there are horns, 7 and 10 respectively. And the crowns are not upon the horns, they are only upon the heads. In Revelation chapter 13, the composite beast, which has the mouth of a lion, the feet of a bear, and the body of a leopard, it also has 7 heads and 10 horns, but this time the crowns are upon the horns. So we have now the beast of Revelation chapter 13, and that is the first half of the chapter, of course. And what power is symbolized by that particular beast?
People.
Good. The papacy. In this case, we have heads, no crowns, and now we have horns, which do have crowns. So it's the opposite way about. We come now to this beast of Revelation chapter 17, and in verse 3, it again says it has seven heads and ten horns, but this time there's no crowns either place. So now we have the Revelation 17 power, and this of course is Great Babylon, and we have heads again, and we have horns, but there's no crown in either place. Now, we recognize, I'm sure, that Bible prophecy doesn't say these things and omit these things without point. That when it specified crowns upon the heads here, that's important, and crowns upon the horns here, that's important, and no crowns, heads, or horns here, that is likewise very important and a very, very clear guide to us as to what the message of these verses actually is. But if we look now, we'll find that in the days of pagan Rome, the head was the political power, and that's where the crown was placed. The horns don't have a great deal of, well, not as great a significance as they do here in the days of the papacy. In the days of the papacy, the head, or the political power, was not the really ruling power. It was the ruling power, but it was spiritual. That was the religious side of the question. Now, the nations of Europe, which gave their support to the head, the various powers, Germany, England, and so forth, they were the political power which supported the spiritual head, and therefore the crowns were once again where the political power was, which indicates that the absence of the horns symbolized a spiritual power rather than a political power. Now, in the last days, then, both the heads and the horns will be spiritual or religious, rather than political. The head, of course, is the woman. She rides upon the beast, and the beast has ten horns. The beast symbolizes state power, and the horns we'll now recognize as symbolizing church power. To confirm this, we have a commentary or two in the Spirit of Prophecy. I go back now to page 983, volume 7 of the Bible Commentary, which reads as follows. In the 17th chapter of Revelation, is foretold the destruction of all the churches who corrupt themselves by idolatrous devotion to the service of the papacy, those who have drunk of the wine of the wrath of their fornication. Good. Now, Sister White says, note the words very carefully, that Revelation 17 foretells the destruction of what? Nations or churches? Churches. But what does Revelation 17 say? Does it use the word churches? No, it doesn't. It uses the word kings. Let's see this now in the first part of the chapter. verse 2. It says, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of the fornication. The Revelation 17 says kings, Sister White says churches. I read it again. In the 17th of Revelation is foretold the destruction of all the churches who corrupt themselves by idolatrous devotion to the service of the papacy. Now, what's the only conclusion we can draw from putting those two statements together? That the word churches in the Bible is symbolic of, pardon, the word kings in the Bible is symbolic of churches in actual fact in this case.
Where did you read from?
Volume 7, page 983, and from Revelation 17, verse 2. Now then, a little further on in this statement, page 982 still, we have this question. What is it that gives this kingdom to this power? Now, in the Bible, what gives the kingdom to this power? And the answer is, of course, these ten kings. Verse 13, these ten kings, have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast, and then they shall make war against the Lamb. So Sister White then asked the question, what is it that gives its kingdom to this power? And the answer? Protestantism. A power which, while professing to have the temper and spirit of a lamb, and to be allied to heaven, speaks with the voice of a dragon. It is moved by a power from beneath. Now then, let's ask ourselves the question. First of all, before we ask the question, we have the information here in the Spirit of Prophecy that Protestantism is at least one of those kings. But does Protestantism today, has Protestantism today acquired a kingdom as yet? No, she hasn't. Is she going to? Right. Now, what kingdom is going to become the support and literally the possession of Protestantism in the very near future? Exactly. Now, the moment that Protestantism gains that kingdom power, then what will she do with that kingdom power? She'll give it to the beast. This we know, of course. However, Protestantism is only one king, and of course there are 10 kings called for in Revelation chapter 17. There is a statement, I've just forgotten where it is now, in the Spirit of Prophecy, which says that though America leads out, every other nation upon the face of the earth will follow in her train. Revelation 14 proclaims the warning to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people against the worship of the image of the beast. Now, if there was to be no image of the beast in Russia, or China, or Africa, or Australia, or Europe, then what point would there be in warning those people against the image of the beast? There'd be no point. So the very fact that the warning goes to those nations against the image of the beast indicates that there will be an image of the beast in those nations. Now, what is it that makes up the image of the beast? It is when the power of the state is devoted to the service of the church. And that takes place, we've got the image of the beast, and it involves, of course, the enforcement of the Sunday worship. That means in Japan, for instance, there'll be erected the image of the beast. But what is the king, the religious king of Japan? Shintoism. And if we go down to the Middle East, what is the ruling king there? Islam, or Mohammedanism, either way you want to say it. And in Russia, of course, is communism, and so forth. Now, the Reader's Digest World Atlas, in the back, there are certain information maps, one of them which lays out the religious divisions of the world. And to my surprise, I found there are exactly 10. I just don't think I can remember them all, but we can try. We have Catholicism, of course. We have apostate Protestantism, there's two. We have Shintoism, Buddhism, Islam or Mohammedanism, Judaism, which of course is a Jewish religion. Then we have various forms of hedonism. Did I say Hinduism by any chance? Hinduism?
Not yet.
Did I say communism? Anyway, you'll find if you check it out, there are just 10 great world divisions of religion, and these will all coalesce into one worldwide confederacy or unity under the leadership of Babylon the Great, which is the unity of Catholicism and Protestantism and Hedonism, bound together, of course, by spiritualism. And once that confederacy has been effected, then the great warfare will begin against the people of God. As I read again in Volume 7, page 983, these have one mind. There will be a universal bond of union, one great harmony, a confederacy of Satan's forces. And shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Thus is manifested the same arbitrary oppressive power against religious liberty, freedom to worship God according to the dictates of conscience, as was manifested by the papacy, when in the past it persecuted those who dared to refuse to conform with the religious rites and ceremonies of Romanism. In the warfare to be waged in the last days, there will be united in opposition to God's people all the corrupt powers that have apostatized from allegiance to the Lord Jehovah. In this warfare, the Sabbath of the fourth commandment will be the great point at issue. For in the Sabbath commandment, the great lawgiver identifies himself as the creator of the heaven and the earth. Now move a little further in Revelation 17 to find the outcome of this struggle. Verse 14 says, "These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he said unto me, The waters which thou sawest where the horse sitteth are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. and attend the horn which thou sawest upon the beast, they shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. So this pictures now a complete reversal. But whereas, first of all, the ten horns give their complete support to the beast, yet those very same ten horns, or great religious powers, with their supporting statecraft, will be the means whereby the execution of the beast will take place. Just as in the fall of ancient Babylon, the very river, which was Babylon's major lifeline and a guarantee of her apparent eternity, was the means to bring about her complete overthrow. Verse 17 and 18 reads, "For God hath put it in their heart to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the one which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth." We'll now turn to final confirmation to the great controversy. Now you recall that yesterday we went to the seven last plagues. Up until the outpouring of that dreadful darkness, I didn't particularly mention at that point the matter of the drying up of the great river Euphrates. So I'll pick it up again from where we left off on page 635 and 636 in the book Great Controversy. The first four plagues were in the previous chapter, followed by a description of the effect of those first four plagues. And now on page 635 we read, "With shouts of triumph, jeering and imprecation, throngs of evil men are about to rush upon their prey, when lo, a dense blackness, deeper than the darkness of the night, falls upon the earth. Then a rainbow, shining with the glory from the throne of God, spans the heavens and seems to encircle each praying company. The angry multitudes are suddenly arrested, their mocking cries die away, the objects of their murderous rage are forgotten. With fearful forebodings they gaze upon the symbol of God's covenant and long to be shielded from its overpowering brightness." Now here in the Great Controversy we have the fifth plague on the top of page 636. Unquestionably the seventh plague is introduced on the bottom of page 636 and across to page 637. Let me read you the seventh plague in these terms. "In the midst of the angry heavens is one clear space of indescribable glory, whence comes the voice of God, like the sound of many waters, saying, It is done." Now, take your Bibles and look at verse 17 of Revelation 16. "And the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air, and there came a great voice out of the temple of heaven from the throne, saying, It is done. And there were voices, and thunders, and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. And the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. And every island fled away, and the mountains were not found. And there fell upon men a great hail out of heaven, every stone about the weight of a talent, and men blasphemed God because of the plague of hail, and for the plague thereof was exceeding great." Now then, in the Great Controversy we have the words, "It is done," and the reference given is Revelation 16 verse 17. In Revelation 16 verse 17 is the words, "It is done," followed by the earthquake and the hail. So if the "it is done" in Great Controversy is the same "it is done" as found in the Bible, then we must expect to find a description now of the earthquake and the great hail. And we do. Let me read it to you. Page 637. "That voice," the voice which says it is done, "that voice shakes the heavens and the earth. There is a mighty earthquake," that comes quote, "such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great." And the quote is from Revelation 16, verse 17 and 18. "The firmament appears to open and shut. The glory from the throne of God seems flashing through. The mountains shake like a reed in the wind, and ragged rocks are scattered on every side. There is a roar as of a coming tempest. The sea is lashed into fury. There is heard the shriek of the hurricane, like the voice of demons upon a mission of destruction. The whole earth heaves and swells like the waves of the sea. Its surface is breaking up. Its very foundation seemed to be giving away. Mountain chains are sinking. Inhabited islands disappear. The seaports that have become like Sodom for wickedness are swallowed up by the angry waters. Babylon the Great has come up in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of her wrath, of his wrath, and that's directly from Revelation 17, verse 19. Great hailstones, every one about the weight of a talent, are doing their work of destruction. The proudest cities of the earth are laid low, the lordly palaces upon which the world's great men have lavished their wealth in order to glorify themselves are crumbling to ruin before their eyes. Now that question, that's the seventh plague. Now if the fifth plague is up here on top of page 636 and the seventh plague is here, what must be in between? The sixth plague. It must be in between. Let's see if we can find it. We go back again where it says, then there comes this blackness which falls upon the earth. Perhaps I'll just try again to paint a picture of the situation here on the board so we can follow it through step by step as it develops. The death decree has been made against the people of God. Probation closes and the time for the death decree is a little over, a little further over beyond the close probation. Plague number 1, 2, 3, and 4, all fall before the death decree actually is due to be executed. When the time comes to be executed, the people of God are, as I drew yesterday, kneeling here in prayer while the wicked stand over them with the weapons raised to bring about the destruction, and behind them the priests and the ministers, of course, are urging them on in their work of destruction to destroy the people of God. Then comes the blackness. Now then, very obviously, of course, these ministers and leaders who urge the people on, they make up the woman. All the people collectively make up the beast, because the beast in this case represents the people. Now you may say to me, well now, perhaps we should pause here a moment, because prior to Revelation 17 we don't find that Babylon is divided into two parts, the woman part and the beast part. There's just the beast part. But that's not a surprise, it's because Revelation 17 to 19 constitute the final revelations of the man of sin, and therefore we are given the most detailed picture of the constitution of Babylon. And doesn't Babylon always consist of two parts? The ecclesiastical leadership, which is the woman, and the waters or people which support that system. And in mystical, literal Babylon in the past, of course, there was the city, and there were the people that, and by the city, of course, we don't mean the actual building, yes we do in this case, and then there was the waters of the river Euphrates, which of course were the life support to that city. And within the city itself, there was another city which was the leadership, Nebuchadnezzar, first of all, and then there were the people who supported that leadership. And the people carried out the will of the leaders. So likewise, in these last days, we have the woman, and we have the waters on which that woman sits. Now, what is the only possible name you can give to that woman, Babylon the Great? And what's the only possible name to those waters? Euphrates. So when the darkness of the fifth plague falls upon this whole scene and blots it out so no one can see anybody, then that mighty river of people, which is about to flood and drown the people of God, is arrested. As I read now, the angry multitudes are suddenly arrested. Now when they're arrested and the forward flow of that river stops, then what has begun? The drying up of the great river Euphrates, which of course is the sixth plague. It now says, their mocking cries die away, the objects of their murderous rage are forgotten, with fearful forebodings they gaze upon the symbol of God's covenant and long to be shielded from its overpowering brightness. By the people of God a voice, clear and melodious, is heard saying, look up, and lifting their eyes to the heavens they behold the bow of promise. The black angry clouds that covered the firmament departed, and like Stephen, they look up steadfastly into heaven and see the glory of God and the Son of Man seated upon his throne. In his divine form, they discern the marks of his humiliation, And from his lips they hear the request presented before his Father and the holy angels, I will that they also, whom thou hast given me, be with me where I am. Again a voice, musical and triumphant, is heard, saying, they come, holy, harmless, and undefiled. They have kept the word of my patience. They shall walk with me, they shall walk among the angels, and the pale, quivering lips of those who have held fast their faith utter a shout of victory. It is at midnight that God manifests his power for deliverance of his people. The sun appears, showing his strength. Signs of wonders follow in quick succession. The wicked look with terror and amazement upon the scene, while the righteous behold with solemn joy the tokens of their deliverance. Everything in nature seems turned out of its course. The streams cease to flow. Dark, heavy clouds come up and clash against each other. In the midst of the angry heavens is one clear space of indescribable glory, whence comes the voice of God at the sound of many waters, saying, it is done. And then comes the seventh plague. Now, a further description of the drying up of the river Euphrates is given to us on page 654, 655, and 656 of this same book, Great Controversy. Now then, before I read it, I want you to have very clearly in your minds the thought expressed in Revelation 17, which says that first of all, the ten kings give their power and strength unto the beast, and then in one great confederacy they make war against the Lamb. But then the same ten horns turn around and hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. So the same people who first of all were carrying out the will of Babylon then become the instruments to destroy Babylon. The same as the river back there in the days of Daniel, where the life support of Babylon and that very river became the means for its overthrow in one single night. And notice too how swift the whole thing takes place. In Belshazzar's day, how long a time was required to bring about the overthrow of that city? One night, or just a few hours in that night. And when this, and it took place, of course, when Babylon felt most secure, most certain of victory, when it seemed as if they had everything in their hands, and so likewise in the final fall of Babylon, it will be at the moment of apparent victory. One more second, and all God's folk are dead and Satan triumphs. At the moment of apparent victory, then suddenly in one single night comes the fall of Babylon. In one single literal night comes the fall of Babylon. Now let's read in the Great Controversy, and I feel it's very important, of course, to put these witnesses side by side, so you see that what the Bible says and what the Spirit of Prophecy says are parallel descriptions of the same great event. Page 654 through 655 and 6, I won't read all these paragraphs because it's too long, but I'll pick out the main points as we move right along. First of all, when the voice of God turns the captivity of his people, there is a terrible awakening of those who have lost all in the great conflict of life. And we just read a few moments ago, back on page 636, when the voice of God spoke and said, it is done. And when the people of God uttered their shout of victory, they're delivered for eternity. Never again can they come under the bondage and power of Roman oppression. Now passing over to page 655. Ministers and people see they have not sustained the right relation to God. They thought they did. They thought that when they were worshipping the creature, they were actually worshipping the Creator, but they were not. They see that they have rebelled against the author of all just and righteous law. The setting aside of the divine precepts gave rise to thousands of springs of evil, discord, hatred, iniquity, until the earth became one vast field of strife, one sink of corruption. In other words, whereas men today think that an offended God is causing all these calamities, they will then come to understand that the violation of law is causing all these calamities. This is the view which now appears to those who rejected truth and chose to cherish error. No language can express the longing which the disobedient and disloyal feel for that which they have lost forever, eternal life. Men whom the world has worshipped for their talents and eloquence now see these things in their true lights. They realize what they have forfeited by transgression, and they fall at the feet of those whose fidelity they have despised and derided, and confess that God has loved them. Now what a change. Those people who'd gone out there murderously intent upon destroying God's people now bow at the feet of the saints and confess that God loves them. So here the saints will be, and the wicked will bow at their feet and confess that God has loved them. What a change. But this soon passes, because the people are preoccupied now with their tremendous disappointment and awful sense of loss. We read further. The people see that they have been deluded. They accuse one another of having led them to destruction, but all unite in heaping their bitterest condemnation upon the ministers. Unfaithful pastors have prophesied smooth things. They have led their hearers to make void the law of God and to persecute those who would keep it holy. Now, in their despair, these teachers confess before the world their work of deception. The multitudes are filled with fury. We are lost, they cry, and you are the cause of our ruin, and they turn upon the false shepherds. In other words, the very ministers who previously had been urging them on in their work of destruction are now the ones against whom these people turn with their weapons of destruction to destroy them. So now the sword which would have slain God's people, and I should put a rainbow around God's faith because they're encircled by this glorious rainbow, and now God's faith being free and clear, and simply with their eyes behold the destruction of the wicked as they're cut down by their own hands. The very ones that once admired them most will pronounce the most dreadful curses upon them. The very hands that once crowned them with laurels will be raised to their destruction. The swords which were to slay God's people are now employed to destroy their enemies. Everywhere there is strife and bloodshed. Now isn't that the same picture precisely as Revelation 17 verse 16? And the ten horns, which are the peoples of the earth, which thou sawest upon the beast, they shall hate the whore. And is that what we're told here? They hate them. They're filled with fury, they cry, and you are the cause of our ruin. And shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. That's the same picture in both places. Reading further now on page 656. A noise shall come even to the ends of the earth, for the Lord hath a controversy with the nations. He will plead with all flesh. He will give them that are wicked to the sword. For 6,000 years the great controversy has been in progress. The Son of God and his heavenly messengers have been in conflict with the power of the evil one to warn, enlighten, and save the children of men. Now all have made the decision. The wicked have fully united with Satan in his warfare against God. The time has come for God to vindicate the authority of his downtrodden law. Now the controversy is not alone with Satan, but with men. The Lord hath a controversy with the nations. He will give them that are wicked to the sword. And since we're in several places in this very same chapter uses the expression for 6,000 years, the great controversy will have been in progress. Go on page 659, talking about that point of time when Lucifer has been chained up for 1,000 years. It says, for 6,000 years, Satan's work of rebellion has made the earth to tremble. For 6,000 years, his prison house has received God's people, and he will have held them captive forever, but Christ has broken his bonds and set the prisoners free. Now, that 6,000 years is very, very close to termination. Generally speaking, we believe there's about 4,000 years before Christ came, and that means, of course, that 2,000 AD will certainly see the 6,000 years out. There's only one problem. We don't know for certain exactly how many years there were before the first coming of Christ, excepting Sister White says that for 4,000 years the race had been weakening in physical, mental and moral power before Christ was born into this world. However, I'm the last person upon the face of the earth to set time. I'll never set time for Christ's second coming because we're warned against it. But this much we do know, that inasmuch as we're plainly told that for 6,000 years the great controversy goes on, and the shoes now at that time has almost run out, and we don't have much time left, do we? And of course the nations of the world are ready. They've been ready for over 100 years or more for the last great conflict, And Satan is just itching to get that battle going, that last great confrontation, and he'd like to start before we're ready. But God will not permit the battle to begin until God's folk have become ready, and the very fact the battle has not yet begun is sure proof that we're not ready. When we are, the battle begins. And when it does, of course, then what a holocaust is going to be. I'd like to read a statement at this moment in regard to the ceiling. It comes from this Bible commentary in a comment upon Ezekiel, the 9th chapter. The volume is volume 4, and the page is 1161. It says, just as soon as the people have got a seal on their foreheads, there is not any seal or mark that can be seen, but a settling into the truth both intellectually and spiritually, so they cannot be moved. Just as soon as God's people are sealed and prepared for the shaking, it will come. Indeed, it has already begun. Indeed, it has begun already. The judgments of God are now upon the land to give us warning that we may know what is coming. And of course, when that shaking comes, it'll be part and parcel of the last great struggle when God purifies the ranks of his people and the remnant go into their death struggle with the great power of Babylon. Now, the fall of Babylon and the Battle of Armageddon, therefore, are very, very closely intertwined, as I think we've come to see, or should have come to see from these verses and statements from the Bible and the Spirit of Prophecy. Therefore, in the study of the demise of Belshazzar and the destruction of Babylon back in those days, we have the type of this final antitypical fulfillment when these things will take place. And this will give us a very, very clear indication of who the kings of the east actually are, referred to in verse 12 of Revelation 16. Let's go back there now and read that verse again, and we'll draw some conclusions from what we've learned so far. And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. Now we have learned from Revelation 17 that the waters called Euphrates comprise every single apostate person upon the face of the earth, right? It doesn't indicate Western kings to the exclusion of Eastern kings, but it indicates all the people upon the face of the earth. Now therefore, if that is so, then the kings of the East, geographically of course, such as China, Japan and so forth, cannot be peoples from this earth. That's not possible. And can you follow that argument through very clearly? We've established the point, haven't we, from Revelation 17 and 19 and the Spirit of Prophecy, that every nation, kindred, tongue and people is involved in the symbolism of that water. In other words, those waters here they are, which support that beast, are all the kings of the earth. It's for all kings of the earth. They include the kings of China and Japan, Shintoism and Buddhism, as we saw previously. And therefore, those kings of the East are not the ones whose ways are prepared by the drying up of those waters, because those kings themselves will be dried up in the drying up of those waters. Therefore, very clearly and plainly, the kings from the East of the sun rising must be kings other than kings of this earth, and that's who they are. The next study period, we have 2 minutes left right now, we'll go back to Isaiah 45 again and show how King Cyrus could be a type of Jesus Christ and nobody else but he, and that therefore the way for the second coming of Jesus Christ will not have been made possible until that great river Euphrates has been dried up. If you go back to Great Controversy, we'll find there that the description which I just read to you in regard to the drying up of the river Euphrates, when the wicked turn upon each other and destroy each other, that immediately after that, Christ appears in the clouds of heaven, but not before. Immediately after. Because the way of the kings of the East is not made possible until that great river has been dried up. Then Christ can come, and then Christ does come, without delay, immediately after that point of time. Now this means then that certain events must yet take place beyond the preaching of the gospel to every nation, kindred, tongue and people before the second coming of Christ is even possible, because the water is dried up so that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And those of you who heard, of course, who heard the Seven Angels series, either from me personally a couple of years ago, or was it last year? Last year it was, and it was a couple of sessions back, 1 year back, or have heard the tapes in the meantime, will understand something of what we're saying in this particular connection. In other words, the purpose of the great controversy is to clear away the misconception in regard to God's character, which can be only done by demonstration. And it will be by the demonstration of God's character that the 144,000 deliver even wicked men from their misconception of God's character, and thus bring about the completion of the purpose of the great controversy. That dries up that water, and then, and only then, can Christ return in the clouds of heaven.